Most of us are probably familiar with the story of the temptation that Jesus faced in the wilderness. We may be less familiar with the story of the Buddha's temptations. In the Buddha's story, the demon god Mara is cast in the role of the tempter. The Buddha faces Mara's temptations at the precise moment he is on the verge of finally achieving enlightenment. After a long and arduous spiritual journey over many lifetimes, the Buddha at last is sitting beneath the great Bodhi tree about to achieve enlightenment. And it's there that these temptations confront him. Now, there are many different versions in Buddhism of just what these temptations were. In some of the versions, the first temptation was a temptation of the flesh. Three voluptuous women flirtatiously walking by as the Buddha meditates. A second temptation common in the stories is one simply of brute intimidation. Mara comes charging at the Buddha atop a huge elephant. Mara's got 100 arms, and each arm carries a menacing weapon, and a huge army is arrayed behind him. In most of the versions, the Buddha, as this group comes to attack him, the Buddha simply touches the earth. And he asks the earth to testify to the Buddha's numerous acts of compassion. And the earth does so in such a loud and overwhelming way. The earth is a powerful planet that this great army is scared away and flees. The third temptation in many of these stories is much more subtle. Mara comes up to the Buddha who's meditating and starts whispering in the Buddha's ear. He whispers congratulations to the Buddha for his amazing spiritual development. "You are so profound," Mara whispers. "Too profound for ordinary people. They won't understand you. It's useless to try to teach them. They just won't get it. They'll be better off if you just keep your ideas to yourself." My guess is that this third temptation was the hardest for the Buddha to resist. Now, I doubt that the pride appeal was very effective. The Buddha seems to have been someone of a deep and genuine humility. But what might have given the Buddha pause was the idea that people would struggle to understand his teachings. I know many Buddhists who will readily admit that it is a daily struggle to understand the ideas the Buddha taught, especially the most simple ideas among those. I certainly have struggled to understand Buddhism. There's times when I think I finally have a concept figured out, and then the fog seems to descend once again. So listening to Mara whispering in his ear, I could easily see the Buddha concluding, "Yeah, my ideas probably are beyond the ability of many to comprehend. It just caused them frustration to wrestle with them. Maybe the compassionate thing is to keep my ideas to myself." This third temptation is an example of what the Buddhists call a near enemy. The American Buddhist Jack Kornfield defines near enemies as qualities that arise in the mind and masquerade as genuine spiritual realization, when in fact they are only imitation. Put simply, a near enemy is a negative spiritual quality that pretends to be a positive spiritual quality. And one way to tell the difference between the two is that the near enemies ultimately separate us from our true deepest selves and from other people, whereas the positive spiritual qualities, the genuine qualities, in fact, help connect us with ourselves, with others. So when the Buddha is tempted to keep his ideas to himself because they're too complex for people, they're too confusing, they're too confounding, it is the bad qualities, the negative qualities of pride and selfishness that are masquerading as compassion. And had he given in to the temptation, the result would have been separation. Separation from his true self, from his mission, from other people. I think the second temptation faced by Jesus in the wilderness, in the reading Karen just shared, I think that second temptation is another example of a near enemy. Now, in that temptation, the devil offers Jesus unparalleled earthly power. And I have a hunch that this is the temptation that would have been the most difficult for Jesus to resist. Now, I don't think the power itself would have appealed to Jesus. Like the Buddha, he seems to have been a very spiritually mature person, that he wouldn't crave power for its own sake. But think what Jesus could do with all that power. Well, he could feed the poor and clothe the naked. He could release the imprisoned and the enslaved. He could make justice roll down like waters over all the nations. He could enforce peace upon this earth. Jesus ruling the world as a political king could make all of that good stuff happen a lot easier than trying to change one heart at a time. And so I think that temptation would have been tempting for him, a person of such deep commitment and compassion. So in this temptation, earthly power masquerades as a way to quickly bring peace and justice to the world. But of course, being a political ruler, even a benign one, would have been totally contrary to Jesus' spirit. And to his mission, he would have lost his soul. Becoming an earthly ruler would have separated himself, from other people. Well, this idea of near enemies is a focus of Buddhism and some of the sacred texts. And I want to lift up four examples of near enemies from the Buddhist texts. The first is the near enemy of loving kindness. Now, the opposite of loving kindness is hatred. Hatred, obviously, is not a spiritual virtue. It's very easy to tell the difference between loving kindness and hatred. But the near enemy of loving kindness, this one is harder to fathom, harder to see and tell it's different. And the near enemy is attachment. It's not so easy to differentiate loving kindness and attachment. Attachment can so effortlessly masquerade itself as love. They look so similar. But loving kindness ultimately is about the well-being of the beloved. Attachment is about the well-being of self. Loving kindness is unconditional. Attachment is conditional. Loving kindness is free and open. Attachment is clingy and controlling. A second example of a near enemy in Buddhism is the near enemy of compassion. Now, the opposite of compassion is cruelty. Again, very easy to tell the difference between compassion and cruelty. But the near enemy is pity. Much harder to tell the difference between compassion and pity. Compassion, though, brings us together. When we feel compassion for the Japanese people, we see them as sisters and brothers, as related to us. We try to empathize with their pain. But when our compassion morphs into pity, we just feel sorry for them. And ultimately, with pity, I think we see other people as lower, as qualitatively different, as other from us. So compassion brings us together. Pity ultimately separates. A third example is the near enemy of sympathetic joy. Now, the opposite of sympathetic joy is jealousy. The near enemy is comparison. So rather than being consumed with jealousy, when I compare, I simply note what another person has and compare it to what I have. I notice that my neighbor has a nice new car and I don't. I noticed that my neighbor has more hair than I have. Now, these comparisons are more subtle than jealousy, but in the end, the impact is similar. They separate. They don't connect. And fourth, the near enemy of equanimity. In Buddhism, equanimity is a great spiritual value. It's being able to be balanced in the face of whatever life dishes up. The opposite of equanimity is anxiety. The near enemy is indifference. And there's a subtle contrast between equanimity and indifference. I think the contrast has to do with caring. I think when we're experiencing equanimity, we care for another person, for what's happening. And when we are indifferent, we simply don't care. So can you see what's so tricky about these near enemies? There's such an incredibly fine line between a virtue and its near enemy. Again, when you have opposites, compassion and cruelty, there's no fine line. It's clear. But the difference between compassion and pity, that's a much finer line. Pity sometimes fools other people. Sometimes it fools ourselves. We think we're being compassionate, but really we're just engaging in pity. So this is why the near enemies are such a deep spiritual challenge. Well, so far, I've been theoretical, giving you examples from Buddhism, examples from the temptations that face Jesus or the Buddha in the stories. But of course, spirituality really becomes important when we apply it to our own lives. And so my hope today is that you will be able to think of the near enemies in your lives. And the truth is that different enemies stalk different people. And that you can often find what your near enemies are by first looking at your greatest virtues. Very often the near enemies are lurking very nearby. So let me share a few examples from my own life. I think one of my good virtues is that I am a gentle person. I've never been in a fight, a physical fight in my life. I've never even been close to a physical fight. And I feel like this is a good thing, that physical violence is not a very good spiritual trait to have. But what's the near enemy of gentleness? I think the near enemy is being a pushover. It's putting too much value on pleasing other people, not offending other people, so that there will never, ever be any possibility of a fight. And the truth that this near enemy obscures for me is that there are plenty of ways to stand up for what's right, to stand up for justice, short of engaging in physical violence. So when my good quality of gentleness morphs into being a pushover, what happens is that I forget, I don't seek nonviolent ways of standing up. I just kind of sit in my seat and let injustice happen. A great example that unfortunately has happened too often in my life is when I hear someone say a blatantly bigoted remark and I'm just silent. Now, I think getting up and punching that person in the face would not be a spiritual response, but neither is silence. And for me, the one I have to be more mindful of is the silence. A second related virtue of mine, I think, is patience. I'm a patient person. I always see things in a very long time frame. I can tolerate slow, even snail-like progress if it feels like we're moving in the right direction. And this is generally helpful in the work of social justice. It takes so long to get anywhere in trying to build a better world. It's easy to get discouraged. It's easy to just give up if you feel like there should be quick progress. But the near enemy of patience is acquiescence. And this is what I have to worry about. It makes me think of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when he occasionally got fed up with his white northern allies who kept telling him, go slower, be patient, incremental change is good, you're going too fast. He knew that sometimes, many times, you need to push hard, even when the promised land seems so far away. And I wonder, if I was one of those white northern allies in 1965, would I have heeded Dr. King's call to come to Selma? Or would my near enemy have kept me rooted in my comfortable cocoon, counseling patience, going slow? I know how I'd like to answer that question. I would have been on the first bus down to Selma. But that may be spiritual self-deception. I'm not sure truthfully how I would have answered. One more example of a near enemy in my own life involves this fellowship. Now, I think something very significant is happening here to Unitarian Universalism in the Fox Valley. This congregation has grown enormously in a place that's not supposed to be hospitable to Unitarian Universalism, in a time nationwide where our faith has plateaued and in the recent years even started to decline. I think there are some very important lessons that other UU congregations could learn from our story. This makes me glad that our fellowship's profile has begun to rise in the last few years in the UU Association. And I've been thinking lately that maybe we should be more intentional about sharing our story. What is the true motivation of this for me? Is it compassion and concern for other UU congregations? Or is it a desire to get a little better known, including personally? Am I motivated by altruism or by ego needs? Very fine line between the two. And here's the trouble with the near enemies. You need a lot of self-knowledge to be able to tell where you are in relation to that fine line. It takes a deep awareness of your motivations. And a lot gets in the way of this self-knowledge. Like the fact that most of us want to be good people. Most of us don't aspire to be hateful, racked with jealousy, cruel people. We'd like to be loving. We'd like to be compassionate. We'd like to have equanimity around us. Succumbing to the masquerades of the near enemies makes it easy to live with a false understanding of ourselves as good people, as great people. Perfectionism is another impediment. Braving an honest look at our own near enemies causes one to realize how imperfect we are. And this makes us uneasy, especially if, like me, we tend toward perfectionism. So examining ourselves honestly is hard work. There's no easy way to do it. It doesn't just magically happen. Self-knowledge and the mindfulness that self-knowledge can give us takes spiritual effort. It takes consistent effort. It takes practice. It takes spiritual practice. This is what Buddhists try to do when they meditate. It's what Christians try to do when they pray. In spiritual practices, you try to peel away the layers of false ego and false pretenses and false motivations. You try to find out who you really are. You try to look at yourself, the real, imperfect, beautiful you. And only then can you arrive at greater self-knowledge. Only then can you arrive at greater mindfulness. In thinking about practice, I realize that practice implies imperfection. If you play the trumpet perfectly, you don't need to practice. You're already perfect. So the greatest trumpet virtuosos admit their imperfection every day when they practice. The same is true with spiritual practice. Spiritual practice is really only for the imperfect, which is to say everybody. The Buddha, I think, understood this. I think Jesus understood it. And I believe when the Buddha meditated and when Jesus prayed, they were admitting their imperfection. But spiritual practice, like practicing the trumpet, is not easy. It's often discouraging. It often feels like you're taking two steps back for every step forward. Sometimes it feels like you've been in the wilderness for 40 days without food. Sometimes it feels like the world's coming at you like an army with a demon god in the lead riding an elephant. It's so easy to give up. But spiritual practices hold a promise of enormous payoff. They don't guarantee this payoff, but they give us a chance at it. And what is the payoff of a spiritual practice? Well, it's not building a defense against uncertainty or pain or loss or doubt or danger. The potential gift is greater self-knowledge and greater mindfulness so that we act and speak in a way consistent with our values and beliefs. The potential payoff is greater wholeness. So here's a question I invite you to ponder this next week before Karen's sermon next week on spiritual practices. Is this potential of greater self-knowledge, greater mindfulness, greater wholeness, does this potential make spiritual practice worth the work? Does it make it worth the effort? Does it make it worth the sweat and tears? Are you willing to invest in a spiritual practice?